and welcome to Book Talk. I'm Sasha DeBoyle, and today we're going to be talking about Neil Gaiman's hotly anticipated new book for adults, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. Helping me to decide whether The Ocean at the End of the Lane is a hit or a miss are one half of Graphic Scotland, whose name is Ariadne Cass Moran, and Scottish Book Trust's operations manager, Michael Murillo. The Ocean at the End of the Lane is a pretty simple story at the heart of it. Our unnamed protagonist takes a journey back to his childhood haunts and upon arrival remembers an adventure he had years ago with a young Letty Hempstock who had been 11 years old for a very long time. The book's gotten rave reviews both on Twitter from our followers and in the wider media at large. No one seems to have a bad word to say about it. What were your impressions of the book at first? Do you think it lived up to the hype?
I'm not generally a huge fan of Neil Gaiman's prose, but that's because my first encounters with him were his comics. So actually the Neil Gaiman comics were what sort of reintroduced me as a grown-up back into comics. So I tended to find his novels after the Sandman series a little bit too whimsical, a little bit empty and insubstantial somehow, and I couldn't quite put my finger on why. And I think it may well be because when you're a writer, you kind of, you take all your stuff, whether it's trauma or memory or whatever, and you turn it into something else. You transubstantiate it into something that's a story rather than a misery memoir or a direct recollection of what you've experienced. And I think what he's managed to do here finally is to introduce a little bit of intimacy into his writing. He's actually written this story about how he lost his heart, and he's managed to show us a little bit of it. So it's a little bit more grounded, it has a little bit more weight than his previous stuff, which is why I really like it. I think he's managed to achieve something very balanced, finally, and very intimate and very special. So yeah, this may well be the first Gaiman novel I've sort of wholeheartedly properly enjoyed.
Well, that's good to hear. Michael, what did you think?
I quite enjoyed it. I like most of Neil Gaiman's stuff, but in terms of his novels, I found this one to be very similar to both Coraline and the Graveyard book. It's narrative, you know, boy meets girl, boy and girl have crazy adventure, boy grows up to become quite ordinary. That structure is replicated in most of his stories, and it's interesting that that's a story used very much in children's books. As this book is supposed to be for adults, I'm not sure it necessarily works because, while it might have intimacy, I don't think it has the punch that you would want in, I suppose, an adult book, because basically it resolves itself in a very nice way. Maybe that's not good enough for adult books, because I don't think life resolves itself always in a very nice way.
You're right. Like, the book does kind of head towards that, like, lovely sprawling, life is very messy and has lots of things going on area, and then it kind of pulls back from it at the end and ties it up really neatly. And I think that for me is definitely what I found was missing. Like, I loved it and I thought it was lovely and gentle and intimate, but very simple. And what I really was looking for was another American Gods, I think, because conversely to you, Ari, I love his prose. Like, American Gods is just such a beautiful, meaty mess of a novel. Like, it just grabs you and you don't want to put it down for days, and that's what I wanted with this. And I mean, I couldn't put it down, but you know, it took an hour or two and then I was done and I was like, what is that? Is that it? Where's the rest of it? A lot of the reviews have actually said that they thought it was aimed towards children, including A.S. Byatt, actually. Do you think that The Ocean at the End of the Lane is actually a kid's book?
No. I had deep thinks about this. I think that what he's done here is really cleverly juggled narrative position so that what we get is a children's book and what we get is the language of a very young boy. But we get this language, this really simplistic, deceptively simple language told from the point of view of an adult whose memory is unreliable. So we've got this beautifully sort of balanced thing. I remember at points kind of stopping and thinking, I would give this to any kid and they would recognize this stuff immediately. There's an awful lot of horrific stuff in it, that a lot of sort of loneliness, a lot of heartbreak. There's a point, for instance, where he talks about the books he reads when he reads books about boarding school girls and their adventures, and he wishes that his life was as clean cut, that the crime and punishment that occurred in his life was as clean cut as those boarding school children, because they get caned and then it's over, whereas with him it's this constant emotional kind of turmoil where nothing is quite resolved because his father refuses to hit him. And I don't know, I think if you were a kid you'd recognize this very much, But I think you're not going to recognize an awful lot of this stuff until you're an adult. I think there's an awful lot of stuff here about memory and perspective that you're probably not going to be able to grasp until you've gone to the other side, as it were. So I think this is an adult's book that is also for children, but I think it's for the children inside adults, if that makes any sense. It's sort of about that layering of realities, all those things that can be true at the same time. It's possible to be an adult and a child at the same time. We don't kind of progress from being one and then turn into an adult who's immune from monsters. It's a book for grown-ups, but only just.
I'm not sure. What is a children's book? Is it a book written with the express purpose of being read by children? Or is it a book that is written that is accessible to children? And I think all of us are, I mean, we're all pretty avid readers, and we read adult books when we were young. Does that make them kids' books? Well, no, they were adult books because they're written for an adult audience. But this book, I think, is a kid's book because it's accessible. The language is very good. It's a very simple language. It's not very complex. Although there are some graphic scenes, you know, especially in the bathtub, and you know, there's some nudity. There's that really awkward.
Yeah, it does feel like it's almost been thrown in, though. That one bit of nudity, and there's a sexy bit. And I mean, obviously seen through the eyes of the child. But you do kind of think, has he just thrown that in so it's a bit more adult appropriate?
Yes, I think that's the only thing that sort of stops the book from being a children's book, really. That one moment of, but maybe that's a very adult perception. I mean, if I was a kid reading this book, would I find...
It would probably just glass over. You wouldn't even notice it, I don't think.
Maybe it would haunt you for life. Maybe the bit in the library where he sees his father and Ursula Monkton. I mean, maybe that would be just as violent an emotional punch as having his kitten die. Maybe that's something that would be hugely upsetting if you're a kid and you read this book. I would give this book to any child to read, absolutely, but I would say this was a grown-up's book that I was giving to a kid to read.
You're absolutely right that there are elements of this book that you can only understand if you've had a chance to develop memories, especially unhappy memories, with the chance to reflect on them. The narrator is for the adults, and the boy is for kids. I mean, he's got a very typically Neil Gaiman kind of supernatural adventure story. But the understanding of the boy, he doesn't get it. Like when he sees them, he sees Ursula and his father, he doesn't really understand what he's seeing, but he knows it's wrong. And I think most kids would understand, they might not get it, but they understand that something is wrong.
We've been speaking a lot about the narrator throughout the course of this. The one thing that I found very odd about the narrator is that he's not named at all, to the point where when I first started reading it in the prologue, I actually thought it was like autobiography. I thought it was leading in. It was Neil Gaiman talking about his life and like sad things that had happened to him. And so, I mean, it may well be linked to things, but obviously it's all fiction. But it was an interesting one because, you know, you never really get to know the protagonist that much. He's very plain and he kind of goes through the motions as like a small child reacting to those situations. How did you feel about the protagonist? Do you think he occupied enough of the story, like in terms of that, or do you think he's just something that external forces acted upon, which is something very traditional of children's books where there's a child and then a new person comes into their life who affects them, teaches them something, and then they leave?
I'm not a huge fan of this unnamed narrator. I think he's a bit dull and I don't trust him because he actively states his memory aren't good. And at the end, it's reinforced by another character that you don't always remember it the way someone else did. And that makes me question the entire book. I'm not a huge fan of unreliable narrators because I would like a bit of consistency in my stories. He told us a story, but we also get him arriving, telling a story, him leaving. Really? Just tell me the truth is what I want to know.
Well, I think it's interesting you kind of talk about truth. I think this book is about how we make stories. It's about how stories absolutely occupy a place in reality. So it's about a layering of realities. And I think at the core of the story, because it is so at the core of it, when you strip away all the myth and you strip away the heroes and the monsters, it's actually a very simple story about a boy who experiences a series of traumatic events. And from those traumatic events, you know, he kind of builds this reality around it. And I think it may well be because he is, at the heart of him, he's an absence. You know, he's empty. At some point, he's had his heart ripped out. So really, he's a conduit for heroes and monsters. He's really not a person. He's not a complete character. He's a gateway. He's a, you know, he's a thin place.
He's a door.
Exactly. He's a door. He's where monsters and heroes come through. And I think at the heart of his childhood and his, you know, his kitten being run over and all that stuff, you know, at the heart of this terrible stuff that happens to him, this very ordinary English life he has. I think he realizes that his world can no longer be relied upon. He realizes that his ordinary, mundane existence is unreliable. His parents are unreliable. His heroes are unreliable. So what he has to do when he finds himself stripped suddenly of people he can rely on, but surrounded by monsters, is he constructs heroes to deal with it. He makes himself a safe place that he can go to. I think that's why I think it's such an intimate book, because what he's showing us is where his safe place is. He's showing us why he makes stories to begin with and where that comes from, that drive to create.
He does it so delicately, and it's such a fine line that, and it's one that makes me really like sad at heart, I think, for the kid in me and the person that loves magic and wants it to be real, because you spend a lot of the latter part of the book just kind of weighing up. You're like, right, which reality is the reality he constructed in the narrative of the book, and which is the one that was actually happening, and which one was dealing with what, which traumatic event prompted which thing? Because, I mean, for example, there's, you know, the section with his dad, which is quite a dark moment, where his dad refuses to hit him and then finds a way to deal with him that does not involve hitting him, that is absolutely terrifying. You know, that's under the influence of Ursula Monckton. But you're like, actually, is this under the influence of a supernatural monster, or is this something that was actually happening and you've now created this narrative around it to deal with it? And then obviously at the end, it's bookended by someone questioning that narrative and the narrator. It all just goes around in circles in my head, and I just hope the magic part was true.
That's because it's a beautiful circular structure, yeah, isn't it?
It's very well written.
It's a beautifully structured thing, and it does make us ask a lot of questions, but I think the answer I came to at the end of it was that it's all true, it's all real, and magic and stories all occupy exactly the same mundane place. They can all be true.
How you remember events can be a truer experience than the reality behind it, and so both are as relevant and important as each other.
Absolutely.
We talked a little bit about the dark moments in the book, and they are quite frightening at times. Were you creeped out by those bits? Because I definitely was. I read it on a plane, and I was like, I had people squished in next to me, and I was like, oh God, this is horrible. And I kept like looking at the other passengers being like, you don't know what's happening. I don't know how to fix it.
Which bits especially did you find really terrible and frightening?
The bit with the dad, like, it's such a well-told, grim relationship.
Yeah.
And the whole, like, I'm not going to hit you, but I will do everything but that. And obviously you can do a lot of horrible things to someone without hitting them.
I think that those big moments are sort of, I don't know, I think there's so much stuff very subtly, very delicately sort of leading into them that gives you sort of little glimpses of what his childhood is like. Just really simple ways the language sort of brings that out. Like when he says, oh yeah, when they're eating dinner and he doesn't want to eat the dinner because it's been made by the babysitter, and he says, I was scared they'd force me to eat. Firstly, you kind of go, Jesus, I used to be scared they'd force me to eat. You know, that's one of those recognition moments where you kind of go, oh yes, that's what childhood is like. I'd forgotten about that. That's very cool that he remembers that and that he sort of served that up again. Just so simple. I was scared that they would force me to eat. It's only mashed potatoes, man. I mean, it's from an adult perspective, it's really not very scary.
There are strange lesson things that happen when you're a kid like that. My older sister, I'm pretty sure, had her mouth washed out with soap once for swearing. And like, is that not the most horrific thing ever? Like, I imagine the reality of it was like someone put soap near her mouth for about a second. That it was a story that became part of kind of like family canon. It becomes this big fear, doesn't it? So maybe something happened before and he's like calling attention to it.
Yeah, but they're all wee things. I mean, it's all about psychological warfare rather than actual active crime and punishment, clean cut stuff. I think that's sort of why he wishes things a little bit more direct and easy.
In terms of like the darker moments of the book, I thought Neil wrote him quite well in that he doesn't have much of a moral understanding of life yet. He's only 7 years old. The worst thing that's ever happened to him was his kitten died. So he doesn't judge his father when he sees his father through the window. He knows it's wrong, but he doesn't judge his father on it, as an adult would. And I really like that, because he travels through life facing all these dark, a series of very dark actions, but he doesn't really judge, because he's got no precedent to judge them on, even to scene with the father. It's wrong, and he's absolutely terrified. In his mind, he's worked it out that maybe his father isn't himself, or maybe he's saying that to make himself feel better about his father. But he doesn't necessarily blame his father for his actions. I really liked that about the darkness of the book, because it is, there is dark. He has no real interest in anything except himself until he is confronted by his own demise, his imminent demise, once he sees what happens to to Ursula, he realizes that actually there is an end. There could be an end to him.
I love all the parts with food. It's such a lovely nod to traditional fairy tales, because in traditional fairy tales, if there is like a bad fairy person, you're not supposed to eat the food. It's like rule one, don't eat the food or you're stuck there forever and everything is horrible. So I liked that he was like, I'm not going to eat this food. And then it became quite sinister. But then that when he was in a safe place, he was allowed to eat. And there's all this like delicious food. It just made me really hungry. And again, I read it on a plane and the food is not good there. It was very sad.
See, this is why there's a wibbly wobbly line between it being a grown-up book and a child's book, because classic children's books always have fantastic food. Enid Blyton, fantastic food. Roald Dahl, Within Limits, excellent food. The Harry Potter books, really good food.
Best food.
Really classic kids' books always have amazing food. Always.
I kind of felt that the food in this book was magical in terms of, because there's quite a bit of magic and supernatural in this book. His interaction with the food at the Hempstock Farm was magic. Somewhere it says something, he can't control anything except for enjoying his food. And he just does that. And that's really lovely about the kind of the magic of, I guess, the joy of the magic of food.
There's food, a lot of stuff magical. That sort of really takes you into the mindset of a young child, though. There's just so much brilliant language stuff. Like, I don't know, there's a chapter that just opens with, the next day was bad. Because that's how you think when you're a kid. Was this day good or was it bad? It was bad. Today was a bad day.
It's kind of what you were saying about the narrator and the fact that he can't judge the actions of other people in the book. He's very young, and so he doesn't have the kind of social skills and the social whatever to kind of view good and bad, but he also doesn't have the social finesse or whatever it is that makes you a grown-up that understands things. I clearly don't have it.
Well, he's a very particular kind of child as well, because he has no social skills whatsoever. He doesn't have any friends. He doesn't have any framework for how to deal with social situations.
He's just one older sister, which can't be a good thing.
He was a bit of a brute to him. In that very kind of sibling rivalry way.
I did think for like the first half of the book, I was like, this kid is kind of whiny, gotta say.
Well, in terms of moral compass, let's think back to the beginning of the book. His biggest concern when they find the opal miner is, where's his comic book?
Exactly, right? He has no concept of how to deal with these big things that are happening to him.
That's absolutely spot on, because children are completely amoral. You have to be taught morals. You have to be taught this stuff. And you get this, you know, you're taught your morals from your books and from your parents and from your friends. And if you have no friends and your parents are unreliable, then you learn your moral compass from your books. There's going to be a moment where you work out that the world is not as clear cut as the morality in books. So, yeah, basically this kid's got nothing. Did you read any sort of paratext around this book? Like, did you read reviews or Amanda Palmer's blog before you got a chance to read the novel?
No.
I did read the interminable Amanda Palmer blog before you asked me to do this, actually. So it was an accident. It was all lower caps.
Well, you know, it's just a style of writing that happens on Tumblr
days. Don't excuse the style of Tumblr, Sasha. It was hard to read. But the point she made was that it's a very personal book that he wrote to try and give her some explanation of something or other. I don't know. But the central point she made in this blog was that she put some pictures of blenders up as well to illustrate this point, was that when you make fiction of any kind, whether you're writing a song or whether or not you're writing a thing, you take your personal stuff and you take your made-up stuff and you blend it. And sometimes the stuff you make is when, you know, you could read it and, you know, the personal stuff is practically indiscernible from the fiction, then you wouldn't be able to work out. You wouldn't be able to look at this book and work backwards and kind of go, I see, when you were 8, you liked cats, I see. Like, you wouldn't be able to kind of gauge with any certainty what's real and what's based on wibbly-wobbly creative stuff. She seemed to think that this book is a more personal thing. You can actually see more sort of roughly chopped Gaiman than finely whizzed Gaiman.
Which is funny, because actually the more we talk about the book, the more I think this is one of his best structured and most delicately like put together books of all his prose and all his comics. Like, this is definitely, I think it's the smartest in terms of its structure, at least.
I really, really agree. I really wanted to not like this book very much so that I could come here and actually talk about something and have a nice fight. But I really agree. I think this is it's just so nice. It's so round. It's just a beautiful structure. It's a delicate thing.
It's like a really good dessert.
I would agree that it is an excellent book. It flows incredibly well, and it just reads, and you want to read it. And the character, the poor boy, man, he suffers page after page after page of either, you know, stress or anxiety of the future, the past, the present, or, you know, like present terrors chasing him through the fields. And it's just a lovely book. For me personally, it's really unimportant whether it's his life or whether it's wibbly wobbly. Like, it doesn't really matter. Like, I'm not bothered whether it's made in a blender or like a food processor or anything. It's just an excellent book.
Well, that about brings us to a close. A massive thank you to Ariadne and Michael for helping us take The Ocean at the End of the Lane to pieces today. If you have more to say about the book, please let us know your thoughts on the podcast page of the reading section of ScottishBookTrust.com. Share them on our Facebook page or tweet us on @ScottishBKTrust via Twitter. Don't forget to tune in 2 short weeks' time when Ryan Van Winkle will be bringing you a bundle of bookish interviews, news and readings worth tuning in for. And remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on Podomatic, iTunes or listen in direct on ScottishBookTrust.com. Thanks for listening.
Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser, with music by Sam Gallagher.